From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a record number of open LGBTQ candidates are running for office in Texas, how Texas college campuses are dealing with the growing number of Nazis, and old folk stories of Abraham Lincoln visiting slaves in Texas. It didn't happen, but in a way, maybe it did. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Early voting in the Texas primaries starts on Tuesday. Democrats and Republicans are picking who will be their nominees for the November 8th general election, and there are a record number of members of the LGBTQ community on the ballots. Rice University political science professor Mark Jones says the rise of LGBTQ candidates is a reaction to the failed Texas bathroom bill.
Well, I think it's part of the larger rise in Democratic candidates that we've seen this cycle. That is, an overwhelming majority of these LGBTQ candidates are Democrats. And it's part of a rise of Democrats that we've seen coming out of the woodwork, in part in response to Donald Trump, and then specifically here in Texas in response to the bathroom bill, which was debated but finally blocked in the Texas House during the prior legislative session.
How many are we seeing?
Right now, we are at least at 50, and I think and counting, because those 50 include primarily people running for the more visible seats, such as state representative, U.S. representative, and governor, and some judges, although as time passes, I think we just find ourselves going higher and higher. That is, we're already at 50. And with each passing month, someone else comes out and says, oh, well, this person who's running for county commissioner or running for a trial court judge is also a member of the LGBTQ community. So it's 50 and rising. In past elections, we've been looking at more something around the 15 to 20 range. And we're also seeing, I think we're both seeing an increase in terms of the quantity, but also in terms of quality, and especially running for high-profile positions. So, for instance, on the Democratic side, Lupe Valdez, who's a lesbian of the former sheriff of Dallas County, is running for governor. Likewise, CD23, which runs from San Antonio down to Eagle Pass and out to the lower El Paso Valley, you have Gina Ortiz Jones, who has the potential to both win the Democratic primary as well as the general election in November, and thereby become the first member of the LGBTQ community openly to represent Texas in the U.S. Congress.
When we talk about the LGBTQ community, these individuals running for office, they are individuals. They're not a monolith.
No. And
so are we going to see a diversity of political opinion? And
well, you see some diversity, but with a few exceptions, such as Shannon McClendon, who's running the Republican primary in District 25. That's northern Bexar County and then up into Comal County. Almost all of them are Democrats. So one thing that there is almost near uniformity is that all of the members of the LGBTQ community who are running on the Democratic side. Now, within that group, you have some variance, both in terms of their ideological positions, but also in terms of the support they're receiving from the LGBTQ community. For instance, Lupe Valdez, in spite of being a front runner and a lesbian, has not been endorsed by the Houston GLBTQ caucus, who instead endorsed her rival, Andrew White.
Just because you're running doesn't mean you're going to win. We all know that already. So why make a big deal about LGBTQ political candidates if they haven't won anything yet?
I think one thing it shows is changing attitudes. That is, 20 years ago, outside perhaps of Austin, anyone who ran as a member of the LGBTQ community could almost be assured of losing. That's no longer the case. Where we've seen successful candidates such as Anise Parker, a three-term mayor in Houston, or Lupe Valdez herself, a four-term sheriff up in Dallas County, having success. And I think the more candidates you see running, the more it's seen as the norm and the less of a stigma or a negative being a member of the LGBTQ community represents for a candidate.
If they win the nomination and they go to the general election, and then typically, as you say, many of these are Democrats, they'll be facing a Republican. Does that Republican face some challenges in coming up with an opposition argument and not trying to demonize the opponent simply because of their membership in this community? And could it backfire on them?
Well, right, for a Republican, it does get a bit tricky in the sense that on one hand, there's sort of a knee-jerk tendency to try to use it against the candidate. But what we've seen in recent election is that while that type of position may work in the Republican primary, it's likely to be counterproductive in the general election where you're going to alienate more voters than you attract. Because attitudes towards things like same-sex marriage are changing dramatically in Texas. And if you look at the support among millennials, as well as among members of Gen X for same-sex marriage, it not only is significantly higher than their grandparents and parents, but it is evolving and becoming more progressive with every passing year. So attitudes are changing in Texas, and this large number of candidates is a reflection of that.
So we saw the bathroom bill and the argument that was put forth that this somehow was a public safety issue. Have you noticed any kind of regret or some sort of buyer's remorse that people put forth this bathroom bill in the political sphere now?
No, I think more than anything else, what you're seeing is it being somewhat swept under the rug by Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and many of his supporters, because they realize that, right, that it's not really even that good an issue for the Republican primary, because it was never really a salient issue for most Republican primary voters. It was something of a manufactured issue that, with the fires constantly stoked, you did get some activists coming out saying that the legislation needed to pass. But without the stoking of those fires in a constant way by Lieutenant Governor Patrick and others, there isn't really much resonance or support for the position that's really strong and intense within the Republican primary electorate. And Republican officials know that in a general election, it's a losing issue. That is, while in a general election, Republicans are on the wrong side of a majority of Texas voters with the bathroom bill, which isn't something that's supported by a majority of people who vote in November. There may be sort of very lukewarm majority support for it in the Republican primary, but by and large, it's not a salient issue for Republican primary voters, so they're not going to vote against the candidate solely based on their position on the bathroom bill.
It's going to be hard for them to ignore, I imagine, and pretend like there was never a bathroom bill proposed in Austin and it wasn't being put forth by Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and he called it a winning issue during those times. They can't just pretend like that didn't happen, especially when we have over 50 openly LGBTQ candidates, you know, on the ballot.
Well, it makes it more difficult, and actually, win or lose these candidates' presence on the ballot reminds Texas voters of the issue and essentially calls on many Republicans to justify legislation that these individuals, as well as a majority of Texans, view as discriminatory.
Rice University political science professor Mark Jones says there is a record number of LGBTQ candidates in the Texas primaries. College campuses across the nation are reporting a spike in the number of pro-Nazi hate speech flyers, banners, pamphlets, and demonstrations in the last year. And Texas college campuses could be experiencing this trend more than in other states. Texas universities appear to be grappling with how to deal with this issue that shows no signs of going away. In fact, it's growing. Candace Byrne and Jordan Buckley write about the problem of Nazi messaging on Texas college campuses for the Texas Observer. Byrne is also an editor and reporter for Truth Out.
According to the Anti-Defamation League, in terms of this ongoing guerrilla propaganda campaign that we're seeing on college campuses in particular, Texas is really taking the brunt of that with more incidences of this kind of white supremacist propaganda than elsewhere in the country.
So what's a good example of a college campus that is seeing this guerrilla campaign?
In terms of what we reported on, it'd really be Texas State University, which is, Texas is taking the brunt of it as the state in terms of most incidences. Texas State University is taking the brunt of it in Texas. So Texas State is arguably has had some of the most incursions of Nazi activity on its campus, perhaps nationally even.
Texas State University in San Marcos traditionally had been known sort of as a laid-back school. Why there?
That is a good question. I don't think I have a good answer for that in particular, other than that it is just easily accessible to this group, Patriot Front in particular, but just these white supremacists are readily available to hit that one.
Now, Texas State University also named this week one of the United States' worst colleges for free speech. That's according to the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, which is a libertarian-leaning nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that says this is a problem.
Right. Yeah, I would love to speak about that more, in particular because I just want to start by sort of putting out my background. I've been long graduated, but my alma mater is the University of North Texas. And actually, in 2009, as a young student journalist there, I participated in a campaign myself to eliminate free speech zones on my college campus, and we did that by contacting FIRE. And FIRE basically wrote the administration a letter. As a result of that letter, the free speech zone policy was abolished. So I think it is interesting that FIRE would, you know, similarly look at San Marcos. And one thing I think is really important to bring up about this is, you know, for all of the emphasis people put on, you know, protecting the speech for white supremacists to be able to fly or and do what they do, people are not looking at the implications here for free speech protections for students of color. And San Marcos is a really good example of this because you had the case of Rudy Martinez. He is a young student of color who wrote an inflammatory article at the student newspaper there called "Your DNA is an Abomination." And really, he was writing to sort of criticize the construct of whiteness. You know, it became a very controversial article, and the student newspaper there experienced a lot of backlash as a result of this and was threatened in different ways. And I think it's just as important to point out that, hey, you know, we should make sure that we have speech protections for the young student journalists who are publishing this, and as well as for students of color. I'm not advocating in any way that folks should be simply arrested for posting a flyer. I would never advocate for that. I think that there are ways for universities to take a more proactive approach to white supremacist speech, hate speech, without actually violating free speech protection. I think that it's sort of an unhelpful dichotomy when we pit free speech against, you know, being vigilant and standing up against this Nazi activity on campuses.
So let's make sure that we are saying that there is Nazi activity on campuses. Is this an organized, coordinated effort? Is it this one guy with an account at Kinko's? How do we know what's going on?
So what we tracked largely, we focused in our article about a group called Patriot Front, which came out of a splintering, actually, post-Charlottesville. This group started off as Vanguard America, which you may have heard of. And then they, for a while, they were calling their Texas chapter just Texas Vanguard. And then Charlottesville happened. And as a result of all of the obviously bad press that came out of that, there was infighting and a splintering, and bloodandsoil.org was created and Patriot Front. That is Patriot Front site. So from what we have looked at, this is definitely a Patriot Front led in a lot of ways campaign. And in fact, you know, the communications I obtained, even FBI investigators can confirm that. They're talking, they're communicating to these campus police departments, and they're even saying, yes, we can confirm this is white supremacist related slogans, images, that this is indeed, you know, you can trace the roots of some of these phrases, you know, back to the 1930s, frankly.
The real Nazis.
The real Nazis.
And some people are trying to make a connection between the rise of this type of activity and the election of Donald Trump to the presidency.
Yes, Yeah, I mean, we definitely started seeing, you know, this activity right in the aftermath of the election. I can say that I started seeing, you know, on my own just social media feed, and I still live in Denton, Texas, where my alma mater is. Just in my community, I'd seen on campus these flyers myself. And I hadn't seen anything like that before the election. They just started cropping up right after the election of Donald Trump.
We have Nazis putting up flyers. Why is that a problem?
Well, so it is more than putting up flyers. I mean, some of these flyers are calling for, you know, one says, it is your civic duty to report illegal aliens. So that is sowing fear among the undocumented community, undocumented students, for one thing. But it's more than posting flyers. I've talked to a couple of students here who identify as Jewish students, or are Jewish students, and they have been harassed online. One person talks about being filmed on campus, and as a result of this, she suffered online harassment quite a bit, and photos of her were repeatedly taken. And other students, like Rudy Martinez, who I mentioned, who wrote this column, the flyers that got posted down in San Marcos were of him. They took his face, they put it on a flyer, they put his employer's phone number, his home contact phone number, his personal address, they put all of his information on a flyer and posted it up around San Marcos. So that is a tactic known as doxing, which most of the time Nazis do online. They'll release personal information about somebody over the internet. But in this case, they did it via flyers. So, you know, that's very arguably inciting to violence. That's an open call to make threats against this young student who wrote this column.
Question is, does a campus like Texas State University, do they shut down attempts by groups like this to have their free speech? And then we have just recently the Texas senators coming down from Austin having a hearing about problems of free speech on campus at Texas State University.
Right. Yeah. And again, this is that dichotomy that I think is really tricky. I don't actually think it is a question of should we restrict free speech rights on campuses in order to protect students from Nazis. I think what you're seeing is you're just seeing a different universities are responding to this activity ways. You have really passive responses on one end, and then some more proactive ones. For instance, you know, SMU, when they got hit, they sort of released surveillance video of the men who came onto their campus and posted up some of these flyers, and just kind of invited the community to help identify them. That doesn't mean they're going to be necessarily criminally charged for doing that. But on the other end, you have Texas State University, which my co-writer on the piece did a records request to them and asked them for records pertaining to the arrests. Not arrests, but five men were apprehended there and let go. They were sort of caught red-handed in the posting of flyers. So he requested records pertaining to that incident, and the university chose to redact the names of those men, choosing to sort of protect their identities, and they're not students. So, you know, it kind of begs the question of why are they going out of their way to protect these men's identity? It doesn't mean criminally charge them for engaging in, you know, free speech protected activity, but I think certainly the student body would want to know who they are, just for the knowledge of the student body who are arguably, justifiably concerned about this speech.
Candace Byrne writes about the problem of Nazi messaging on Texas college campuses for the Texas Observer. Byrne is also an editor and reporter for Truth Out. There are many stories of Abraham Lincoln. More books have been written about the great emancipator than any other American. But there are stories about Lincoln that aren't in the history books, stories about his secret visits to slaves in Texas. William R. Black writes about these folk tales and about their deeper meaning for the Atlantic magazine.
According to Bob Maynard, who lived in Marlin, Texas, about 20 miles southeast of Waco, there's this person who came upon this plantation, you know, sometime before the election of 1860, just a stranger. Nobody knew who he was. The plantation owner took him in. And the stranger looked around and paid close attention to how the slaves working on the plantation were treated, what they had to eat, which wasn't very much, as Maynard said, something like 4 pounds of meat and a peck of meal a week. The stranger saw people whipped and saw families torn apart through sales, and eventually left and went on his way. And then a little while later, he writes a letter to the plantation owner, says that he's going to have to free his slaves, that everybody was going to have to. The North was going to see to it. And he told the owner to go in his room where he had slept when he was staying as a guest, and the plantation owner would be able to see where the stranger had carved his name into the headrest. And so the slave holder goes in, and sure enough, there is the name A. Lincoln.
Now, this story, apocryphal, but it's interesting. It tells you so much, even though with almost 100% certainty, we can say this didn't actually happen.
It would require a massive conspiracy to hide the fact that Lincoln made these trips. Yet it's some 40 different formerly enslaved people made similar claims when they were interviewed by people working for the Works Progress Administration back in the 1930s. I think it says something to us in that today historians often debate about, you know, did Lincoln free the slaves or did the slaves free themselves? Was emancipation something that was top down or bottom up?
Or was it just, was it inevitable at the tide of history?
Right. What we see in these stories about Lincoln coming down and being in disguise as a peddler or a beggar, and snooping around, seeing what's going on and conspiring with the slaves and often sort of making a fool out of the slave owners, tricking them almost like a Brer Rabbit figure. It tells us that these survivors of slavery saw emancipation as something that was neither top down or bottom up, but something that had to be kind of done with actual people, and Lincoln had to get his hands dirty, so to speak, and come down south and work with the enslaved people to win their freedom.
Well, these are stories that were probably part of the oral tradition, passing of knowledge from one generation to the next, and that means something because these stories are tweaked and refined, and if they didn't resonate with a population or a need of that community at that time, then they would have been forgotten, not to be retold. So there's some currency in the fact that this story was originally crafted and that it was passed along and remembered.
I think that's right. And I mean, you can sometimes hear in the story, you might see a kind of kernel of historical truth, like perhaps that something happened with a Union soldier, particularly because a lot of these stories come out from the South Carolina Sea Islands, where there was an early Union presence. But yeah, it's a way of these marginalized people throughout the South for them to say that they were part of this story, that, you know, it mattered that Lincoln had to come down and work with them. I mean, I think we have all seen in our own lives, you know, I grew up in Memphis, and, you know, everyone has some sort of, you know, story in which Elvis pops up everyone seemed to have known Elvis. And it's a way of saying that they are important too.
It's a very, almost a religious type of a telling.
Yeah, you know, I think about another story told by a woman named Virginia Newman. And she was in sort of Jasper County, Texas. And she claims that Lincoln came through her plantation in a big carriage and shook her hand and told all the white people there that they needed to free their slaves. And she says something I think is really telling. She says, "Some folks say that ain't Abraham Lincoln, but I knowed better." And I think she's almost saying, like, I know maybe that wasn't actually Lincoln, but that's not the point. I know better. There's a point in telling this story.
So this is also a population that was isolated and cut off, and they were deliberately not given information about the news that was happening around the world. They were, and so frequently they had to generate their own news based upon bits and pieces that they've picked up. And so,
right.
You know,
you see something similar with the way that the story of Juneteenth spreads and changes. And it's a way for African-Americans to make emancipation a story about themselves. And we have to keep in mind, this is a time when we're talking about the late 19th, early 20th century, and really throughout the 20th century, a time when Black people were being written out of the Civil War, when they were being written out of emancipation, Reconstruction, when they were being made into side actors. I mean, just think about, you know, how many people didn't even know that there were Black U.S. soldiers until Glory came out in 1989. You know, I mean, that required decades of its own kind of myth-making to write Black people out of the story. So we have that whole time, even though in the mainstream narrative is trying to write these people out of, one of the central events of our history, that African-Americans are crafting their own rivaling myths, saying, no, we were there and we mattered.
So in history, we pay close attention to fact and what we know and what can document. And obviously, Lincoln didn't go to these places. There's no documentation to support it. It would have taken all this effort. Texas at that time was highly suspicious of strangers talking to their slaves. Anyone doing that would have been hung immediately. How do we include these stories that aren't Jake with the facts yet have importance?
That's an interesting question. You know, I've gotten more than one email from people who maybe didn't quite read carefully enough, who said, there's no way the Lincoln, you know, made these visits. And I can't believe you're trying to peddle this, you know, obviously false story. It's like, well, sure, did Lincoln make these trips to the South? No, but people did tell these stories. And that is something that happened in the past. And stories are important to how we understand ourselves, how we understand our relationship to politics and to the nation. Since often when we're talking about survivors of slavery, particularly in rural areas like East Texas, you know, we often don't have a lot of things that they necessarily wrote down. A lot of them were, you know, illiterate or semi-literate. So if we want to understand how they understood themselves and their past, then we should pay attention to the stories that we do have from them, even if they take the form of folklore rather than, you know, traditional history.
William R. Black is a doctoral candidate in history at Rice University. He wrote in The Atlantic magazine about the folk stories of Abraham Lincoln's secret visits to slaves. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, or you can comment directly on our show page or on our website, tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.